Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, take some advice, Pilgrim.
Well, advice is free, but there's plenty of that to be had here on the Patrick Madrid Show. So feel free to give me a call. I'm here to help if I can. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Email that came in here from Peter, listening on the Relevant Radio app. He says, Patrick, love your show. Thanks for all you do. What is the Catholic Church's teaching on this question? A wife has to choose between a husband and the children. It is a regular situation in daily life. Why would the wife listen to the husband, and why would she not have to, because the children would take priority? I believe the husband should come first, but please go ahead and let me know how to understand your answer. And he says, P.S., when are you coming back to Rhode Island again? I'd love to see you. Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Peter. I have fond memories of my last visit to Providence, Rhode Island, but there's nothing on the calendar anytime soon, so we'll just have to do this by radio. Well, in the absence of any more specific information, I'm not sure how to answer your question, so I'll give you a couple of possible scenarios, just reading between the lines. Let's say there's a situation where the wife and the husband and the children are all living together and the children are all underage. So we're talking teenagers and kids, or maybe younger. And the wife, you say, she has to choose between a husband and the children. So one scenario that presents itself to me is that what if the husband wants to bring something bad into the home? Drunkenness, drugs, or other things. And the wife says, no, we have kids, honey. You can't bring that stuff in here. You shouldn't be doing it yourself, number one. But you're going to be putting the children at risk, me too. You can't do that. I mean, I can envision a scenario where the wife has to stand up and say, no, you can't do drugs at the kitchen table. You can't leave pornography lying around. In fact, you can't have it at all in this house, et cetera, et cetera. So in a scenario like that, sure, I could see a situation where the wife, for the benefit of protecting her children from a clear and present danger that the husband might be involved in, that she certainly has the right, even the obligation, to do that. If it's a different scenario where the wife and the husband disagree on something, that is, let's say, are we going to allow the kids, to go to camp this summer? And they disagree. And she says, well, you know, I really don't want them to go to camp. Well, why not? Well, I'd rather have them home here with me. You know, I miss them. And the husband says, well, but, you know, it gives them good experiences. They can learn how to do things, meet other people. It's a good camp environment. There's nothing bad that's going to happen there. I could see a scenario where if you can't agree and the wife wants something for the kids to stay home from camp, the husband wants them to go. Well, ultimately, the husband would make that decision as the head of the house. He would say, well, they're going to go. Hopefully it wouldn't get to that point. Hopefully they could accommodate some sort of a joint decision. That's always the best way to do it, if at all possible. Sometimes it's not possible. Now let's take one more scenario, and maybe this is what you meant. What if the children are all grown up and the wife, you say, has to choose between the husband and the children? Well, if it's a scenario like that, her first duty, of course, is to her husband. She has a duty as mom to these children, but if the scenario is that the kids have grown up, they're on their own now, and she doesn't have to be cooking and cleaning and whatever other things she might want to do for them, and her husband says, I would really like you to be here with me, you know, stay here with me and not be gallivanting, or, you know, maybe that might not be the right way to put it, but maybe he would look at it that way. She has an obligation to put him first. So maybe you had some other scenario in mind, but I don't know what it is. So those are three or four shots in the dark. Maybe one of those is what you meant. And I hope that's helpful. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Bill in San Clemente, California. home of the Western White House during the Nixon administration. Welcome, Bill.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me well?
Sure. Yes, I can.
So my question is, I've been reading in the Gospels that God refers to Jesus as his chosen one. That's in Luke chapter 9 and Matthew chapter 17, verse 5. He says, this is my son, the chosen one. And then in Saturday's readings, it talked about Isaiah saying that Jesus was going to be the chosen one. I'm just wondering if you could, chosen indicates to me that he has a choice, that God had a choice of another maybe way to redeem us. Have you ever thought about that, or am I picking little, you know, needles out of a haystack here?
No, I don't think you're picking. I mean, this is a fascinating question that when you read the passage, it jumps out. Like, what is going on here? What does he mean that he chose him? Without having consulted the church fathers or St. Thomas or some of the other standard sources, I'm just going to go on my impressions from having read this before, and that is that in the incarnation, let's not forget that God himself became a human being. So he joined a human nature in all of its perfections to his divine nature. So you have one person in two natures, divine and human. So the Lord, let's put it this way, the Logos, the second person of the Blessed Trinity, when, as St. John says in John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and then verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. I think we could safely say that in the creating of the human nature that the Lord took to himself, he chose this man, not a separate person, but this man's nature. So in the incarnation, Jesus Christ, the second person of the Blessed Trinity, is a man with a mind and a soul and emotions and an intellect and a will and a body and all those things that are proper to human nature. God chose in the incarnation to create this man, this human nature, and joined it to himself as an instrument for our salvation. So again, without having consulted any of the really knowledgeable people on this topic, my first instinct is to say this is an illusion, not an illusion, to the incarnation and the humanity, the creature in Jesus Christ. That's my initial reaction to that passage.
Okay, that makes some sense to me, because he says, you know, I've knitted you in my womb, all of us, he knows us all, so he just knitted the person that he wanted. He chose to knit Jesus that way. So I find out that's how I'll sort of figure it out in my own head. So that's very illuminating. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Before you go, though, I'd like to offer one little tweak here just to make sure that things are clear. We can't lose sight of the fact that Jesus is not a human person, nor is he a divine person and a human person in the same body. He's a divine person. And as a divine person, the second person of the Trinity, the Logos, he has, he possesses the fullness of divine nature, consubstantial with the Father. So in the incarnation, there's not a second person involved. It's not as though he chose a human person and joined that human person to himself. No, he is the person, the subject of his divine and human nature. But the human nature, it's hard for us to kind of think in these categories here, but the human nature, complete with everything that a human being has, was joined to this person. So like, you're a human person, Bill, with a human nature. It's not as though in the incarnation the Lord chose you and said, I'm going to join you to me, and you now as a human person are going to be joined to my divine person with a divine and human nature. That's where we don't want to make a mistake and assume something incorrect like that.
Yeah, no, I understand the distinction. I get it.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate listening.
You're welcome. And thank you for the kind word. Great talking to you. Let's go now to Anthony in Bakersfield, California.
Bakersfield!
Hello. I was trying to see what the church's teachings are on ayahuasca. It is some sort of plant that they grow in South America. And it is, I've met people who have tried it. They say it's cured them of had depression and other ailments they've had.
Well, the church doesn't have a teaching on that, just like it doesn't have a teaching on peyote or, you know, specific things. I've only heard of this. I don't have any real, you know, serious information about it. I understand that it has sort of like a mood altering, psychologically altering properties, maybe hallucinogenic properties. I think it would fit underneath the church's rubric that, number one, that you shouldn't use illegal drugs. Now, this is whether or not this is legal or illegal, I don't know. But if you're using drugs in a way that would be harmful to your health, or if you're using drugs in a way that would open you up to and loosen your inhibitions and make you vulnerable or prone to doing some things that maybe would be sinful, then that would be to be avoided. So without knowing much more detail about this particular, what is it? Is it, it's a drink of some, oh, he hung up. Oh no, he didn't hang up. There he is, Anthony. No, I thought you hung up, Anthony. No. Okay. So I guess it would be like peyote, right? You'd get high on it and it would open your mind and you'd see things and have mystical experiences and things like that. Is that what this does?
Yeah. You talk to spirits and people get some sort of sudden knowledge about something, you know, kind of cures whatever's ailing them.
Yeah.
Past thoughts and memories and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think it would be sort of prima facie something that you should avoid for this reason, because especially if it's being used as a way to try to get in contact with spirits or get in contact with clairvoyant information or something, that would be in the world of the occult. And so if you're using this as a technique to open that door, then the church would say, nah, don't do that. Let me share with you, it doesn't talk about this particular drug, but it talks about drugs as such. This is the Catechism, paragraph 2291. The use of drugs, and it's not talking about medicine here, but hallucinogenic drugs, the use of drugs inflicts very grave damage on human health and life. Their use, except on strictly therapeutic grounds, is a grave offense. Clandestine production and trafficking in drugs are scandalous practices. They constitute direct cooperation in evil, and they encourage people to practices gravely contrary to the moral law. And by that, it's referring to, you know, if you get high on drugs and then you go out and you kill somebody because you're high, or if you get high on drugs and you go out and sleep with somebody because you're high, or any number of other things, this is where it's encouraging you to do other things that are gravely immoral. And one of those things, by the way, would be trying to get in touch with spirits, trying to get in touch with, you know, knowledge or information that you don't otherwise have access to. So I think on the merits of this section of the catechism, we could safely say that that's a drug that you should avoid.
Okay. Thank you.
Helpful? You're welcome. Yeah. So all the people out there licking toads or eating magic mushrooms or ayahuasca or whatever it's called, I would say put it down and don't do that. Anyway, Anthony, thank you. For those interested, once again, that's paragraph 2291 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Hey, I have a quick email.
Yeah.
This is from Jill, and she says, "Good morning,
okay.
Good morning, Patrick. Both of my parents have passed away. I have been praying daily rosaries and chaplets for them. I have had some holy masses said for them. I was thinking about having Gregorian masses said for both of them, but I don't know a lot about these masses. Would you recommend doing this for my parents? Thank you for your time. God bless, Jill."
Jill, okay, yes, Jill, by all means. A Gregorian mass, this is hearkening back to the time of Pope St. Gregory the Great, who promoted this, and that is that you would ask a priest to celebrate Mass for the intention of the repose of the soul of that person that you are praying for, one Mass each day for 30 days. Now, the customary thing to do is to offer a stipend, and the stipend could be $10 per Mass, $20 per Mass. It's not obligatory, but it's good form, because you're asking the priest to do something above and beyond his normal duties. There are certain perpetual mass associations, you can look those up, and they have something similar, but it's much more, you know, sort of extends to many people, where they will offer masses, perpetual masses, Gregorian masses for your loved one. And they may say, for your offering or your donation of X dollars, we will enroll you in these masses. And in fact, in many of them, it's a perpetual enrollment. So from here until kingdom come, this group will continue to have masses celebrated for the repose of the soul of that person. That's a very good thing to do. You don't hear about that very much anymore. But one thing's for sure, when the time comes, and I hope it's many years in the future, I really do, but whenever the time comes and you hear that I've died, I hope that you will ask the Lord to have mercy on my soul and pray for me. And when you think about it, when you go to Mass, maybe offer your Holy Communion for me, pray a rosary for me. We're all in this together. So you and I are praying for the souls in purgatory now, but eventually we'll be in purgatory, or maybe if we're really holy in this life, we won't have to go to purgatory. But for those who do, especially if you've been in the habit of praying for the souls in purgatory during this life, they will not forget you when it's your turn. If you do have to go there, they'll pray for you from heaven. They'll remember you and thank you. And this is a great way for us to remember that in this life, we have a duty of charity toward our brothers and sisters who are in purgatory right now on their way to heaven. The only people in purgatory are those who are destined for heaven. Purgatory is not a place for people who are too good for hell but not good enough for heaven. Really, purgatory ultimately has nothing to do one way or the other with your salvation. If you die in the state of grace and you are destined for heaven, which you will be if you die in the state of grace, you might have to pass through purgatory, as St. Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning in verse 10, about how on that day that you are judged, the works of your life are revealed. He says they're revealed by fire. And that fire will test the quality of your works. Some of it will be good works, precious stones, gold and silver. Some of it will be bad works. So he likens those unto wood, hay, and straw. So St. Paul there says the bad works of your life will be burned off, or purged, you might say. He says this involves suffering. And he says the person will be saved, but only as though passing through fire. So this person is not yet in heaven, not saved in the fullest sense of the word. So even though he doesn't use the word purgatory, he's describing it there. And notwithstanding the fact that in some, you know, translations of the Bible, you might find a footnote that says, well, this passage doesn't really mean purgatory. Yes, it does. And don't be thrown off by that. The church fathers, St. Augustine, he wrote a whole book on this topic called The Care That Should Be Had for the Dead. And he talks in that book about not only things like proper burial and respect for the remains of those who have died, but also the obligation to pray for them and to ask the Lord to shorten the time that they are in purgatory. So this is why whenever we say, may he rest in peace, may she rest in peace, people say that as a matter of course, perhaps not realizing what it really means. What it means is, Lord, would you please bring that person, if he or she is in purgatory, would you please bring that person to heaven sooner, quicker, faster, so that they can rest in peace? Because in purgatory, they're not fully at peace. They know they're going to heaven. They have the joy and the anxious anticipation of knowing that they're going to heaven. But as it says in Revelation 21:27, nothing unclean can enter heaven. And if in the moment of your death, you are in the state of grace, and yet you have attached to you those temporal effects due to sin, the scars or the stains, if you wanted to use that analogy, of the sins that have been forgiven in your life, well, those things have to be purged. They have to be purified. You'll be covered in the blood of Jesus so that your robe is sparkling snow white. Then you are ready to go into God, into heaven, and see God face to face. So purgatory is a mercy that God extends to those souls who are not quite ready to see him face to face. He prepares them through this loving fire, and it hurts, but it hurts so good, because the souls in purgatory realize that when this is over, their purification is over, they're going straight into the beatific vision. They're going to see God and be happy with him forever and ever. Amen. So you, in this life, have a role to play to pray for those people in purgatory that God would shorten their time there. That's how it works. So we'll take a break. We'll come back. So much good stuff to talk about here on the Patrick Madrid Show, and I'll be coming right back to your phone calls. Oh, and don't think I forgot about that vision by St. John Bosco about young people that go to hell. I will share that with you right after I come back from this quick timeout. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
I had promised you that I would share something that St. John Bosco saw in a vision. He used to see a lot of things in dreams, and this is one of them, and it has to do with young people going to hell. I know it's just a very depressing topic, but it's worth your time to listen to this. So he shared this with the boys at the oratory where he was taking care of a lot of these orphans and poor kids. St. Dominic Savio was one of them. And so he has a bit of a preamble here, but he says, in this dream, he was led to a vast, boundless plain, veritably a lifeless desert with not a soul in sight, nor a tree, nor brook. Yellow, dried-up vegetation added sadness to this desolate scene. He says, I had no idea where I was or what I was supposed to do. And then this guide, who presumably is an angel, shows up and he asks this angel, he says, where am I? Come with me and you'll find out. He led the way and I followed in silence. But after a long, dismal trudge, I began worrying whether I should ever be able to cross that vast expanse. What with my toothache and bad legs, suddenly I saw a road ahead. Breaking the silence, I asked my guide, where are we going? This way, he replied. We took the road. It was beautiful, wide and neatly paved. Both sides were lined with magnificent verdant hedges covered with gorgeous flowers. Roses, in particular, peeped everywhere through the leaves. At first glance, the road was level and comfortable, so I ventured upon it without the least suspicion. But after a while, I noticed that it almost imperceptibly kept sloping downward. Although it did not look at all steep, I found myself moving so swiftly downward that I felt I was effortlessly gliding through the air. Really, I was gliding and hardly using my feet. Our march was fast. Then the thought struck me that the return trip would be very long and arduous. I asked my guide, how shall we get back to the oratory? Do not worry, he said. The Almighty wants you to come back to it. He who leads you onward will also know how to lead you back. The road was increasingly sloping downward. As we continued on our way, flanked by banks of roses and other flowers, I became aware of the oratory boys and a multitude of others whom I did not know were following me on the same road. Somehow I found myself in their midst. As I was looking at them, I noticed that now one, now another, fell to the ground and then was instantly dragged by an unseen force toward a frightful opening in the ground, distantly visible, which led those unfortunate boys straight into a furnace. What makes these boys fall? I asked my companion. Take a closer look. I did. Traps were everywhere, some close to the ground, others at eye level, but all well concealed. Unaware of their danger, many boys got caught, and as they tripped, they would sprawl to the ground, legs in the air. Then, when they managed to get back on their feet, they would run headlong down the road toward the abyss. Some got trapped by the head, others by the neck, hands, arms, legs, or sides, and were pulled down instantly toward that hole. These ground traps, fine as a spider's web and hardly visible, seemed very flimsy and harmless. Yet I observed that every boy they snared fell to the ground. Noticing my astonishment, the guide remarked, "Do you know what that is?" "Just some filmy fiber," I answered. "It seems like nothing," he said, "but it is human respect." Seeing that many boys were being caught in those fibers, I asked, "Why do so many get caught? Who pulls them down?" "Go nearer," the guide said, "and you will see." I followed his advice but saw nothing peculiar. "Look closer," he said. I picked up one of the traps and tugged. Immediately felt some resistance. I pulled harder only to feel that instead of drawing the thread of the trap closer, I was being pulled down myself. I followed where the thread led and soon found myself at the mouth of a frightful cave. I halted, unwilling to venture into that deep cavern, and again I started pulling the thread toward me. It gave a little, but only through a great effort on my part. I kept tugging, and after a long while, a huge, hideous monster emerged, clutching a rope to which all those traps were tied together. He was the one who instantly dragged down anyone who got caught in them. "It would be useless to match my strength with his," I said to myself. "I would certainly lose. I could better fight him with the sign of the cross and with short prayers." Then I went back to my guide and he said to me, "Now you know who he is." "I surely do. It is the devil himself who places these traps to make my boys fall into hell." Carefully examining many of the traps, I saw that each bore an inscription: pride, disobedience, envy, the sixth commandment, theft, gluttony, sloth, anger, and so on. Stepping back a bit to see which ones trapped the greater number of boys, I discovered that the most dangerous were those of impurity, disobedience, and pride. In fact, these three were linked together. Many other traps also did great harm, but not as much as the first two. Still watching, I noticed many boys running faster than others. "Why such haste?" I asked. "Because they are being dragged by the snare of human respect." Looking even more closely, I spotted knives among the traps. A providential hand had put them there to cut oneself free. The bigger ones, symbolizing meditation, were for use against the trap of pride. Others, not quite as large, symbolized spiritual reading. There were also two swords, one representing devotion to the Blessed Sacrament, especially through frequent Holy Communion, and the other sword, devotion to the Blessed Virgin. There was also a hammer, symbolizing confession, and other knives, symbolizing to devotion to Saint Joseph and other saints. By these means, quite a few boys were able to free themselves or evade capture. Indeed, I saw two boys walking safely through all the traps without being caught, either because of good timing, getting past it before the trap sprung on them, or by sliding out of it when they got caught. When my guide saw that I had observed everything, he made me continue along that rose-hedged road. But the farther we went, the scarcer the roses became. Long thorns began to appear, and soon there were no more roses. The hedges became sun-scorched, leafless, and thorn-studded. Withered branches torn from the bushes were strewn along the roadbed, littering it with thorns and making it difficult to walk through. We had come now to a gulch whose steep sides hid what lay beyond. The road, which increasingly sloped downward, was becoming ever more horrid, rutted and littered, bristling with rocks and boulders, and making the march ever more difficult. I lost track of all my boys, most of whom had left this treacherous road for other paths. I kept going, but the farther I advanced, the more arduous and steep the descent became, so that I tumbled and fell several times, lying prostrate until I could catch my breath. Now and then my guide supported me or helped me to rise. At every step, my joints seemed to give way, and I thought my shin bones would snap. My guide said, "My good fellow," "my legs will not carry me another step. I just cannot go any farther." He did not answer, but continued walking. Taking heart, I followed. Finally, seeing me soaked in perspiration and thoroughly exhausted, he led me to a little clearing alongside the road. I sat down and took a deep breath and felt better. From my resting place, the road I had already traveled looked very steep, jagged, and strewn with loose stones. But what lay ahead seemed so much worse that I closed my eyes in horror. "Let us go back," I said. "If we go farther, how will we ever get back to the oratory? We will never make it up that slope." And the guide says, "Now that you have come so far, do you want me to leave you alone?" And he says, "No." So we continued our descent, the road now becoming so frightfully steep that it was impossible to stand erect. And then at the bottom of this precipice, at the entrance of a dark valley, an enormous building loomed into sight, its towering portal securely locked facing our road. When we finally reached the bottom, I became smothered by a suffocating heat, and I could see a dense green-tinted smoke lit by flashes of scarlet flames rising from behind those enormous walls which loomed higher than the mountains. "Where are we? What is this?" I asked. "Read the inscription on the portal and you will understand," he said. I looked up and read these words, "Ubi non est redemptio," the place where there is no redemption. I realized we were at the gates of hell. The guide led me all around this horrible place. At regular distances, bronze portals like the first overlooked precipitous descents, and each one was an inscription such as, "Depart from me, ye accursed, into everlasting fire, which was prepared for the devil and his angels." That's Jesus speaking in Matthew 25, verse 41. "Or every tree that yields not good fruit shall be cut down and cast into the fire." Those are Jesus' words in Matthew 7, verse 19. He says, I wanted to turn back. As a matter of fact, I did try to start to turn back, but my guide ignored my attempt. He says, "Look." I looked up in terror and saw in the distance someone racing down the path at an uncontrollable speed. I kept my eyes on him, trying to identify him. And as he got closer, I recognized him as one of my boys. His disheveled hair was partly bristled and partly tossed back by the wind. His arms were outstretched as though he were thrashing water to keep from going under. He wanted to stop, but he could not. Tripping on the protruding stones, he kept falling even faster. "Let us help him. Let us stop him," I shouted. "Let him go," the guide replied. "Do you not know how terrible God's vengeance is? Do you think you can stop one who is fleeing from his blazing wrath?" Meanwhile, and we're just about at the end here, meanwhile, the youth had turned his fiery gaze behind him in an attempt to see if God's wrath were still pursuing him. He precipitated himself toward the bottom of the ravine and crashed against that bronze portal as though he could find no other solution. "Why was he looking back in terror?" I asked. "Because God's wrath pierces the gates of hell and will reach and torment him even amidst the fire." As the boy crashed into the portal, it sprang open with a roar of change. Instantly, 2, then 10, then 100, then near 1,000 inner doors opened with a deafening screech as if moved by the crash of the youth who was dragged in by an invisible, very rapid, irresistible force. As these bronze doors, one after the other, though each at a considerable distance, remained momentarily open, I saw far into the furnace something like jaws spouting fiery globes at the moment the young man hurtled into it. And as swiftly as the doors opened, they clanged shut again. Now, he has some commentary after that, but that's sort of the conclusion of this description. And I don't think I need, obviously, to overexplain any of this, but I will draw your attention to one aspect of that. And that is how at the beginning, as Jesus talked about, the road to perdition is wide and well-traveled. And he says the gate that leads to eternal life is narrow and few find it. So strive to enter by the narrow gate, Jesus says. So for me, and I first read this dream when I was a teenager, it's in a book called The Dreams and Visions of St. John Bosco. It's published. You can get it at any Catholic bookstore or order it online. And it's filled with lots of these dreams. God gave him visions, things that would happen in the future. Some things that he told him would happen in the future that haven't yet happened. But in this vision, in the dream, he was given to see, and this is my point, and I'll leave it at this, how at first, I'm thinking about smartphones and TikTok and apps and fun stuff. At first, this road is beautiful, and it's more or less level, but it's actually slightly going downhill. And the roses and the beautiful vista and the shrubs, it's just a very pleasant road to walk on. But the further you go down, as you remember him saying, the more inclined it becomes. We use that phrase, a slippery slope. That's what he's referring to. You start walking faster and faster and faster. And before you realize it, you can't even really prevent yourself from going further unless you grab those swords and those knives of the sacraments and the rosary and devotion to St. Joseph and asking the Lord to help you. Those are the people who can get out of those snares. But the ones who didn't make use of those things, they got trapped and they got pulled down to hell. So it's a florid, very vivid kind of vision, but I believe it's absolutely true, and it's a way of understanding how this life can be just like that, where you don't realize it. And you don't want to find out when it's too late. You want to find out beforehand. So ponder that. I have many times in my life. I encourage you to do so as well. I'm coming right back with the last part of this last hour of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Back to the phones. Let's go now to Joe in Passaic, New Jersey. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Pat. Always have to thank God, thank Relevant Radio, thank you, and thank you, Franciscan Friars and Patterson, for setting me straight. The reason I called is about the magic you were talking about this morning. I was thinking, could magic possibly be just be futuristic science that we don't have complete knowledge of? Could it just be that it is spiritual and it is demonic? Or could it be just prestidigitation?
Could be. Yeah, it could be. So what passes for magic could just be a natural phenomenon that we think, ooh, that's magic, but it's really not. But there are also real magic things that can be produced as imitations of what God does by way of miracles. So the devil does have the ability to harness natural powers and things. So if by magic in that sense you mean, could it be preternatural? It certainly could. I guess those are the two options. Either it's a natural phenomenon that appears to be magical but has a natural explanation, or it's something preternatural that is being done by the devil.
No, the devil is doing this. It's basically using his mind to overwhelm our minds and show us things. I mean, like when they say people spit up nails at exorcisms, they're not really spitting out. We just see them do that, or are there actually physical nails someplace that somebody says, this person spit them out?
Yeah, my understanding, Joe, from reading works by, and I don't remember if Father Gabriel Amorth addressed that particular issue, but I think he might have. But just having read some of the works from exorcists, they do indeed see phenomena where the possessed person might spit out a bunch of nails or broken glass or strange objects or toads or other weird things like that. How does the devil do that? I'm not really sure. One thing I can tell you is if you read St. Athanasius's biography of St. Anthony of the Desert, he was one of the very, if not the first major monk who lived in the desert. This would have been in the 200s. The devil tormented him endlessly with fake preternatural spectacles. He would light things on fire, like he would wake up and everything would be on fire in his cave. And when he realized that this was the work of the devil, it would cease because it wasn't real fire. He would see horrible snakes and lions and other things that would come into his cave and try to devour him. But he quickly realized that this was all just cheap imitation, fakery. So the devil can try to create the illusion of reality. He's the ape of God, A-P-E, as he's sometimes called, meaning that he can't do actual miracles that God can do and God's saints can do. But he can sort of give pretend simulations of that, cheap imitations. So that too is certainly something to be aware of. Now, but in any case, obviously you know this, Joe, but for those listening, stay far away from those things in any case. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Janine now in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Janine.
Hi. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hi. Yeah, I had a quick question about the same topic before the Waltons about the magic. Uh-huh. I've wanted to ask you this for a long time. It seemed like a good time now. In John, where it talks about not wanting to lose what we've worked for by inviting people into our homes or even greeting them that don't share the same doctrine. I have a tendency to want to take things literally, but that's a hard one for me to swallow. I don't know what to think about it. So I thought I'd ask you.
Can you repeat what it is, what specifically it is you have a hard time swallowing? Oh,
yes, I can. Yes. Well, John 2:13, okay, where it says, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him in your house or even greet him, for whoever greets him shares in his evil works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of door-to-door missionaries, for example. So when somebody comes to your door and is preaching a gospel saying that Jesus is not really God, he's like a superhuman creature, I would not invite that person into my home. Now, let me take a step back. I would invite that person into my home because I'm prepared to deal with that kind of issue because I have a lot of experience. I'm not saying this to be boastful. I'm just saying this is the work that I've been doing for 35 plus years. So the average Catholic doesn't have that kind of experience. So it's a really bad idea for that. But I'll bet you if one of those people showed up at St. Paul's door, he would have invited them in, or St. John, he would have invited them in so he could help them get away from these incorrect ideas. So there are circumstances where it would be okay to do that. But as a general rule, I think it's a wise principle, obviously, that if somebody is coming to your home and trying to push a teaching, an idea that you know is contrary to the faith, better not to let them in. Just to say, thank you, God bless you, but I'm not interested.
Right. Well, and even greeting them, I've had to let go of a lot of people in different circles that were friends just because I'm not very good at standing up for myself, especially when there's more of them than there are of me, and it just seems like futile. So I guess, you know, it is right, like exactly what it says.
Yeah, although I keep in mind, too, that there are some instances, and this may be one of them, where perhaps St. John was employing a bit of hyperbole, which is exaggeration to make a point. So obviously, in the course of human events, when you're dealing with people, interacting with them, there's a certain propriety, a certain decorum, a certain courtesy that we would give. So if I was in the grocery store and I saw somebody that I knew was a Jehovah's Witness or a Mormon or somebody else who held a view that I deemed to be directly contrary to the truth, I wouldn't ignore that person. I would say hello. And I don't think St. John rather intended that passage be strictly literally understood. I think he might have been engaging in a little bit of hyperbole there, just to show that it's important that you not allow some aberrant ideology into your home, into your mind. So those are my thoughts, Janine. I appreciate it. Thank you. Well, let's go to Mark now in Jersey Shore, PA. Good morning, Mark.
Hello, Patrick. Hey,
hi.
Got a question regarding the difference between civil marriage and sacramental marriage.
Okay.
I have a friend who was sacramentally married, but she is now a widow. And she was telling me that she thought she was free to marry sacramentally. And the reason I'm bringing all this up is, okay, she was married to a police officer, and she receives a pension, okay? And she can do that for the remainder of her life. A priest told her that she could marry sacramentally but not be civilly married and thereby continue to receive the pension. I don't believe that that's true. And I think that in order to be sacramentally married, you must also be civilly married. And I told her, I said, well, I'll look into it for you, do a little research. And, I was hoping you could maybe direct me to a resource that could at least shed more light on that if it's not a question that you can answer. So could you help me out with that?
I'll venture an answer to you, but I can recommend a book that will help you, and it will give you definitely an answer to it. It's called Annulments in the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions. Now, she's not referring specifically to an annulment, but this scenario is covered in this book, and the author is a canon lawyer. His name is Ed Peters. So you're going to get some specific canon law advice from him. I would also suggest a website called canonlawmadeeasy.com by a canon lawyer named Kathy Caridi, C-A-R-I-D-I. And this is although I don't remember reading about the specific topic on her website, I wouldn't be surprised if there's an article on this topic there. But I'll venture an answer. So keeping in mind that marriage can be valid and is assumed to be so, it can also be sacramental. And in the case of, say, just to make it easy, let's just say two baptized Catholics. They get married in the church. They follow the church's canonical form. They not only are validly married in the eyes of the state, but also the eyes of the church. But they also have the benefit of the sacrament of holy matrimony. If it's two atheists or two, you know, Hindus or a Hindu and a Buddhist or whatever, if they get married, their marriage would be valid but not sacramental because they don't have the benefit of baptism. Therefore, they can't confer the sacrament upon each other. But their marriage is still valid. So the validity is not merely a secular civil issue. It is that, but it's not only that. The validity is also something that the church takes into account in terms of the church recognizing that these two people are validly married, even if it's not a sacramental marriage. So in terms of this lady and the law surrounding the pension and however that works, that's something that you would really need to ask a canon lawyer, which is why I referred you to those resources. But the way marriage works in this country, and let's say at a Catholic parish, man and a woman, they get married, they celebrate the sacrament of holy matrimony, the valid civil marriage coincides with that marriage. In other words, it's not two separate things. Their marriage in the Catholic Church is it qualifies, and maybe the canon lawyers might correct me for not using the precise language, but what happens is, so let's say Nancy and I, when we got married, we stood at the altar, we exchanged our vows, it was a nuptial mass, and we were validly married in the eyes of the state. So it was a civil marriage that, as far as the state was concerned, because it satisfied their requirements for a marriage to be considered valid. So this is where maybe there's some particulars in her situation that I wouldn't be able to talk about because I'm not a canon lawyer, but I would consult these sources and see what they have to say. Anyway, Mark, I hope that's helpful. I do have to press on, though. We're short on time, but thank you. Let's go to Stacy now in Berkeley, California. Hi, Stacy.
Yes. Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is this. I've noticed a change in the liturgy when I've been listening to the Mass on Relevant Radio and also at my local parish. After the act of contrition and before the readings, the priest has always said, one God forever and ever. But now it seems it's been changed to God forever and ever. So I don't know if the Pope changed it or what. It personally makes me a little bit nervous about that change, but I'm just wondering if you can provide some information.
I can, yes. Yeah. So this was a change that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops made, but you shouldn't be concerned because they made it more literal. So the Latin prayer does not have the word one in it. And so to be more faithful to the traditional Latin, which says God forever and ever, the addition of one in English is not wrong, but it's not faithful to the original Latin. So what has happened here is in the Collect of the Mass, which is where this appears, they're returning to the more traditional and accurate and literal rendering of the Latin. That's what's going on there.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, thank you for that explanation.
Yeah, happy to. And, you know, it's reminiscent, Stacy, you probably remember this. Remember when there was a change for after so many years during Mass at the readings, the lector would say, "This is the word of the Lord." And remember they changed it to "the word of the Lord." Well, that caused a lot of, you know, ruffled feathers. And I think there were a lot of people who also were worried, well, why are they changing it and they're making it more modernized or something, when in fact it was exactly the opposite. That's another example of where by changing it from "this is the word of the Lord" to "the word of the Lord," then they actually were going back to the traditional accurate Latin of the traditional Mass, verbum Domini, the word of the Lord. There was no "this is the word of the Lord." That was something that was not erroneous, but it was unnecessary and it wasn't faithful to the original Latin. But I remember when they changed it back to the proper translation, some people thought, oh man, they're tinkering again. They shouldn't do that. But it was actually a very good thing that they did. Thank you. Appreciate that very much. Let's see if we can get to Chris now in Fairfield, New Jersey. Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Patrick. Just real quick, there was a caller who called in before about transgenderism in the Bible, and it jogged my memory about a passage I read. I just wanted your comment on it. I didn't know the context of it. It's Deuteronomy 22, verse 5. And I don't know if that would be something that could apply to that conversation.
Right. Right. Yeah, I'll read it. That is an important passage. So this is Deuteronomy chapter 22, 5. A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. Yeah, certainly it is. It sheds light on this issue, and it is an important passage. Some people, just be aware, Chris, they will say, well, in the very next sentence, he says, if you chance upon a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground with young ones or eggs and the mother sitting upon the young ones or upon the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. Well, that's not a perpetual commandment that we have to observe. The one above it, Deuteronomy 22:5, would be an example of where here we see a mix in the same passage of some things that are intended to be permanent or at least significant in a permanent way, and other things that are more provisional. So, yeah, it certainly is one of the verses that would apply to that discussion. I wish I had more time, Chris. Thank you. Well, between now and tomorrow, 21 hours from now, I'll be praying for you. Please do pray for me. I'll see you tomorrow.